I'm Joe Bendosky, and this is Start Writing. Today, my guest is Deke Rue. He is the author of 122 Rules and Birth of American Gigolo. He's also won a Reader's Choice Award for his first book. He has both published indie and small press, so we'll definitely talk about that with him today. And so here's the interview.
So I guess I came across your book in the way I came across most is that as I go through Twitter and follow new authors and different things like that, I'll download the sample of their book and read through the first couple pages and just see how I feel about their voice and their style and their efficiency with words. I think a lot of authors kind of become word snobs and I have a very low tolerance for bad writing. And having read your book, I thought your writing was really good and I liked it. And not only that, but your premise is just really right up my alley. I studied psychology in college and continue to keep up on research and social sciences. And so the idea that you presented these 122 years in psychology and how your characters use them to kind of, manipulate the world is just fascinating to me just from the get-go. Maybe talk to me a little bit about how that idea came to you.
Well, it actually, it started out as just an idea that this person could go into a room or into a situation and control everyone around them. I came up with this concept of how would someone walk in to a room and just control anyone, manipulate them in any way. It seemed to me like there should have been a way for people to do that. And so I thought about it and thought about it. And I was like, well, so this is, you know, you've got people who are really good at, you know, finding people and hunting people. You've got these assassin stories and stuff, but nobody, you know, how would you go about controlling someone? I was like, okay, well, what if there was a faction of the government that specialized in this? Okay, well, what would they do? You know, we're talking about like a sci-fi thriller where they've got like some kind of weird mind control, and I'm like, no, that's too complicated. It's too far-fetched. In my stories tend to be the here and now. You know, I'm breaking that rule because I'm actually writing a sci-fi thriller, but it's not that far advanced. You know, the technology's not crazy out there. I wanted to be able to have a way that anybody could go in and manipulate people and push people around and get them to do their bidding, because everybody knows someone that can do that. They can, you know, they can charm an Eskimo into buying ice, right? And so, well, how would you do that? So you have a secret government organization that's got an agenda, that's got an ulterior motive, and I was like, well, what if they had just they hired the biggest and the brightest and the best people to come up with ways of teaching people how to do this. When you break it all down, human psychology is actually pretty simple. Like I kind of allude to this in the book. Like, the people generally act and react predictably. And so if you analyze enough situations, if you analyze enough people, you should be able to come up with a way in which you can adequately predict how someone will react. So if you can do that, if you can come up with a set of rules, and that's where the ideas of a set of rules came up with a set of rules to go, okay, I want to control people a certain way, you know, what would I have to do? It's like, okay, well, let's take one situation at a time. And so I started thinking about all of these different situations, and I sat down and I wrote out like a set of rules. Like, I started out 122 of them. I just wrote them out and wrote, I was thinking about them all the time. I was just like, you know, and analyzing people and watching people. Yeah, and you watch people and you're just like, you know, sometimes you'd be sitting in a meeting or whatever and you're just watching people and you're like, you know, how would they react if I did such and such? You know, if I said such and such. And so I remember thinking about these different rules like all the time, and some of them I remember like specifically coming up with, because this was a long, drawn out thought process. It took me 7 years to write this book.
Well,
the first draft.
coming up with all those rules and dividing them into situations, I imagine this was a process.
It was a huge process. And, you know, and some of them came with insight, you know, just like boom, flashes. There's one set in there where Sam is fighting in the diner and, he's talking about, you know, where, angry people don't think very well or don't think very clearly. There's three rules, and furious people don't think at all. And there's a set of three. I don't know what the first one is. And I remember the exact moment when I was walking to my car when I thought of those three rules, and I was like, that's very true. I've got no degree in psychology. I took a couple classes in psychology in high school or in college just to meet my my gen ed. But you know, I love to watch people and observe people and interact with people, and so you know, you kind of write these out, and if you just write them out, you can actually come up with, if everyone just sat down and go, if I did such and such, you could probably predict how people would react. And so this just kind of, it kind of evolved. And then when I found a situation and when he needed to really control someone or get some information out of someone, then I applied a rule or rewrote a rule. And so they just kind of evolved.
Very nice. It makes me kind of want to read your book again, discussing how you came up with these. It sounds like it's brilliant, man. It's awesome. So just to help, help the listeners kind of get a feel for you as an author, how would you describe your genre and your style of writing? Like, what's a household, known book or author that's closest to your work?
So, well, I grew up with Stephen King. He's one of my literary heroes. Like, I have this dream of going to dinner with him and like Dean Koontz and, you know, maybe even throwing Clive Cussler in there and Robert Ludlum. And, you know, these guys that kind of shaped my childhood. I read so much, especially Stephen King. Like, one of my very first big books of his that I ever read was It. And I read it three times and it was amazing. And one of my favorite books he ever wrote was Needful Things. Like, I've read that book, I don't even know how many times, like six times. It is a phenomenal piece of literature. It really is just brilliant. In fact, that's where my name derives from, or part of my name does. And my last name, I borrowed from my wife, and that is her maiden name. My first name, Deke, there's a character in his book, in Needful Things, that's got like, he's like, in there for like two paragraphs. But I always loved the name. And so, that was kind of my hat tip to Stephen King. So, I'm not saying that I, you know, and so he inspired me, and then the writing style of Dean Koontz really inspired me. The guy can write beautiful prose. And some of his storylines are just amazing. They're just beyond brilliant. So I take my inspiration from these two gentlemen. And I want to say that I write like them, but I would just say they inspire me. I'm certainly not anywhere near their levels yet, but, you know, maybe someday.
And so I guess if you could have written any book ever, would it be Needful Things, or would you pick something else, like if you could have written any book?
Oh, it's really tough. So it goes back and forth between Needful Things, which of course is Stephen's book, and then Dean Koontz's book. He's got a Moonlight Bay trilogy, although he doesn't have a third one out, so really right into the duo. He's got this, it's called Fear Nothing, and the second one is Seize the Night. Hands down, my favorite thriller book of all time, that series is. He's got, Christopher Snow is the main character, who's got ectodermal pigmentosa, and he's in this little community, Moonlight Bay, and there's an abandoned, military base, and all of this crazy stuff happened at this military base. And he goes on all these wild adventures, but I don't know. It's a toss up between those two books.
Yeah, because I like, with your own style, I don't see a lot of the supernatural, or I guess any at all. Like you said, it's very grounded in the here and our reality.
Yeah, you know, my wife writes fantasy adventure, and she created this whole world, this whole universe, and these religions, these different sects, and all these different things, and these warring people, and this whole situation And like people like her and, you know, and Stephen King and Dean, like these guys have got like wild, crazy imaginations and they can just come up with all this phenomenal stuff. And, but mine really has to be kind of the here and now. Like I focus more on, you know, the characters and I don't know if I could come up with an entire universe like they do. So a lot less supernatural. Although I will admit in the follow-up book, 1.2 Redemption, which I just finished the first run of edits on and I'm putting aside for a couple of months to let that chill. There is a little bit more of the supernatural, certainly in that one, but not anywhere like what these guys put in theirs.
So I guess that's interesting because, like, myself, like, my go-to genre is fantasy. I there's certain writers in the thriller category that I just love. Like, Michael Crichton, definitely one of my all-time favorite authors, and he's the reason I kind of tend to write more of a thriller style. But if I'm randomly picking up something to enjoy over the weekend, I go to fantasy.
Okay, yeah, Michael Crichton is brilliant. And so do you read George R. R. Martin, or you love it?
I think I love Martin, but my all-time favorite is a Brandon Sanderson.
Okay.
I think Martin's plots are more intricate, his characters more interesting, but I feel like Anderson's writing is faster paced and it's just a little easier to enjoy. Although, I guess I need a caveat for, what was it, The Name of the Wind, Rothfuss. Like, his writing is probably the best I've ever read in my life. Like, as far as the voice of the writer, I've never loved anything more than I love Rothfuss's voice. But he only has the three books, so you can't just really indulge, whereas Sanderson prints out huge novels several times a year.
Wow. Okay.
So what do you feel is the strongest part of your writing, and how did you develop it, and how would you teach that to other writers?
I think that the strongest part of my writing is just sky blue imagination. And, you know, I'm not trained. I went to school and I took the normal writing classes. I've actually got a computer science degree. So I never took any of the creative writing courses. Honestly, when I first started this, I was not grammatically strong. But, what I feel like I've got is, the ability to just unleash my imagination and just, you know, let it go. And I think part of that stems from the fact that I don't have a writing degree is when you know all of the rules and all of the formulas and all the structures and everything, sometimes I think things get overthought. I can give you a good example here because I used to be a music major, and when, you know, I was just presented with a chord chart and I was like, okay, learn this. All right, let's go. And you'd be like, okay, well, let's go. And usually if it was just a let's go, let's play this thing right now, then those were almost the best sessions that I'd have versus time where they're like, okay, well, why don't you spend a couple hours, prepare, you know, practice the solo, do all this stuff. And you know, you go in, and what would happen is those things would feel stiff and they would feel forced, because I think that there's like two layers of your mind. There's like, there's one that filters things out, you know, the analytical part and you can do your taxes and you can do all of these sorts of things. And then there's this creative side that if you can just get that analytical part out of the way, it will just go crazy and it'll come up with just like amazing things, but trying to let it off its leash is difficult. So I think if I was trained, like, I don't know if I could let that happen. Like, I don't know if I could get past that analytical part and go, oh, well, this, I should be doing such and such in the plot according to the formulas. So I think not having the degree for me actually works better. So you had another part of the question with how to teach that to other writers. And I would say the only way you could, I don't know if you can teach that to other writers, maybe just trust yourself to create and to let it go. When I'm writing, especially raw content, most of the time I don't even know what's going to happen until I write it. Those are like my favorite writing sessions. When I'm just typing along and I'm just pounding at the keyboard as fast as I can, trying to keep up with what's coming through and the visual that's in my head. And, you know, and my heart's racing and I'm like going, oh my God, what's going to happen next? And so if you can let go of that analytical part of your brain and just let your imagination go, that's the most fun. And that's my favorite way to write. And at least it works for me.
Well, I mean, everybody's different. You know, you probably heard the metaphors, the gardener and the architect, or the hamster and the potter. So it sounds like you're definitely a gardener there. You just plant and see what grows.
Yeah, exactly. I just throw the seeds on the ground and go, okay, let's go for it.
Yeah, see what happens. Yeah, everybody, I think it's kind of a spectrum and people land on different ends, but you definitely sound on the extreme end of the gardener style.
I absolutely am a big time pantser.
I can't do that. Like, I remember because I read a ton of books on craft, and there was one writer who was talking about the difference. And he says, for the longest time, I would wake up and stare at that blank page, and I dreaded it every single day until I plotted things out. And then I would sit down at the blank page, and it didn't feel overwhelming. I knew where I was going, and the stress of writing was gone. And it was in reading that I began to see my own style, that, you know, if I had a place to go, I didn't dread the blank page. Whereas it sounds like you look forward to the blank page. You know, there's an adventure to be.
There is. I love it. And you know what, though? There are a ton of just amazing authors who do plotting. This is just the style that works for me.
Yeah, it really is just about finding that style that works for you. Okay. So you've written two books. You're working on your third. And, I mean, you said you were working on 122 years for, what, 7 years? So
yeah, it took me 7 years to write it.
So if we go back to when you first started writing fiction, what would you tell your amateur self? Like, what piece of advice would you give yourself before you started the whole process?
What I would go back and tell myself is if I could go, hey, here's what you need to do before you even start writing this thing, is that is to look up the rules on word count. So the very first draft of 122 rules was almost 150,000 words long. And I spent about 4 or 5 months writing it, and then about 18 months editing and editing and editing. And I got it to where I thought it was pretty good. And I had some beta readers who read it, and they're like, yeah, this is pretty decent. Here's some things we fixed and stuff. So then I started getting into the query writing process. So, you know, we're talking three and a half years into this process of working on this, or 3 years to the end, I would say. And lo and behold, I ran across this site, or I got some feedback from someone that said, hey, just an FYI, the max word count for a debut thriller novel for adult writing is about 85,000 words. You don't want to go above that. And so it never even occurred to me to look this up. So I started researching it, and I'm like, this completely sucks. So I went back to the drawing board, and I broke the story up into two books, and rewrote it. And then what happened was the second book that I originally written is it still hasn't been completed yet. The follow-up novel, Redemption, is just the continuation of the story that I'd started from the first one, from the rewrite. So there's actually a third and maybe even a fourth book to be written, but right now I've got this other one that I'm working on. So that is the number one rule I would say, is go back and learn all of the rules before you get going. You know, and this is where my just throw it against the wind and just go for it, throwing the seeds out there, can bite me in the butt. I didn't pay any attention to that.
Okay, so you ended up going indie. So at that point, the word count is irrelevant. So how do you feel about that now? Right? Because, I mean, when I buy a book on Kindle, I don't look at the word count. I don't care.
Right. And the only reason you really, there's a couple reasons why you care. First of all, is I did go small press, and they do care about the word count, because you don't want a debut novel to be too long, because printing is too expensive.
You went small press? I didn't know that.
I did go small press. Okay. Yeah. No, the, Birth of American Gigolo is self-published, but 122 Rules is small press.
Yeah, cause, And I think that's where the rules on word count come from, is it's more about the publishing company not wanting to run too many extra pages. And a thick novel from an author you don't know is a little intimidating, but when it comes to digital, you can't tell how thick it is.
Absolutely. And, you know, and part of it is, though, if you're querying to agents and stuff, one of the first things they're going to look at is word count. And if the word count doesn't fall into the right bucket, you're going to get ejected.
Okay. So which book came out first, 122 Rules or Birth of American Gigolo?
The Birth of American Gigolo came out in the middle of January, and then in April, 122 Rules came out. And the interesting thing about these two books, is that they're overlaps of the other. I don't know if you've read Birth yet, but there's a character in it from Birth that's in 122, and even in Redemption, there's a couple of characters that are also from Birth that are in Redemption. And I was writing 122, and this woman, Lindsay, who is a jaded housewife who just finds out that her husband is cheating, decided she was going to tell me her story right in the middle of this book. And so I'm going along, and I'm like, this has nothing to do with my story. But she decided it was time for me to tell her tale. So I'm like, okay, I just rolled with it. And so when she was done with her story, I pulled it out, you know, stuck it on the shelf and waited, you know, got the editing done on the other book. And then while it was going through the process with my publisher, my wife and I sat down and we're like, okay, we need to edit this thing, get it out. And we went ahead and self-published it.
Why switch from indie to the small press if you'd released that first book that way? And what do you plan to do with Redemption?
Small press, the indie book is just kind of a debut novel. It's going, hey, you know, world, here's a small book. You know, I didn't really think it was worth going and getting a press on it. You know, going through small press and getting this one done. What happens is that this one gives me a lot more control. It's a small novel, and I can give it away. I can sign it. I can run promotions. I got complete control over that thing. Whether you go with small press or whether you go with big press, you give up a lot of control. So, I queried with 122 because I decided to go small press or decided to go indie with Birth from the very beginning because it was so small and I wanted control over it. But in 122, I was querying, and I entered PitMat, and Panda Moon Publishing, they liked my tweet, and so I sent them the first couple chapters, and then real quick, they asked for the rest of it, and so they went ahead and they offered me a contract on it, and I was like, yeah, let's go with these guys. You know, they really sounded like they had their stuff together. And, you know, I liked what they had to say. And so, it's a long process to go through to get this thing published. But, you know, I learned a ton going through a publishing company.
Hmm. Like what?
They paired me up, with a content editor. Her name is Anya, and she's a completely brilliant content editor. Lots of experience, lots of books under her belt. And, you know, we restructured 122. We made it linear, a lot more linear, right? it was not linear at first. This thing, like, timeline wise, it hopped all over the place. It's funny. I always joke with my wife that, you know, time doesn't necessarily mean as much to me. Like, she's like, when did such and such happen? I can't remember dates. I can be like, it might have been 3 or 4 years ago. I will remember how I felt and what I was thinking, but I won't necessarily know a timeline. And my book reflected that. It hopped all over the place. And so Anya really, really helped clean that up, you know, and there's nothing quite like going through that editing process and getting that first editorial letter when you think your book is pretty good and it's like a sucker punch. You're just like, wow. But, you know, you get the second one and it's not as big of a blow, but you're a little more emotionally prepared for it. And, you know, and by the third and the fourth one, you're like, yeah, this is pretty decent now. You know, she worked on the content and, you know, my wife is she's a grammar Nazi is what we always joke about. And she's brilliant on grammar. And so I learned a ton from her. So between these two people, Like, I learned a ton about writing from them.
So what's the plan with Redemption? Will you go small press again? Are you contracted through the series, or will you go indie?
I am contracted through the series for Redemption. You know, we're working on, we're negotiating contracts right now. There's a couple of things that we don't quite see eye to eye on yet, but you know, we're working through them. So I'm hoping that we'll be able to clear that up and, get that one out. The next book I'm writing is completely out of, it's not even the 122 series, it's completely different. And so, I'm not even sure where we're going with that. I might even try and go big press on that one, see if I can get an agent.
So, what's your experience with the marketing end of the small press? I've heard a lot of writers say that they feel like they're just on their own. What's your experience with the company you're working with?
It is a lot of that. There's not a lot of great ways to do marketing without spending a lot of money or spending a lot of time. Panda's biggest marketing is to build your brand. That's one of the things that they did teach us, is to, like, you know, get your website up, you know, establish who you are, you know, get all of your ducks in a row so that when people look at you and they look at your book, they know who you are. Because there's a million books out there, but people want to know who you are. They get to know you, and then they might be more interested in your book. You're not going to get someone to read your book by continuing posting, you know, hey, read my book, read my book, read my book. People aren't going to respond to that. They're inundated by that every day. But what they're motivated by is knowing you. You know, that was one of the things that Panda brought up. That's one of the things that my wife has brought up. She runs a small publishing company also. You know, that is what they teach their authors too, is build up your brand, build up your following on Twitter, interact with people, interact with your fans, you know, write your blog posts. You can spend a lot of money. I haven't done it yet. I haven't spent a lot of money on, we've tried a couple things on Facebook here and there, and we go to Comic Cons and do that sort of thing for marketing. But, it's a lot of, there's a lot of noise out there. And so you really have to work hard to stand out.
So it sounds like the weight of the marketing is still very heavy on your shoulders. Like, they do some coaching, but the actual labor is still your job.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And we go out and we drum up, you know, people who do the reviews. And I did my own blog tours. You know, my wife and I did a blog tour together. And, you know, we promote ourselves as the Ruse. We've got Ruination, you know, as a website. And we're trying to, you know, we're coming up with new things. And, you know, with the leader of Ruination is Trina, our cat. And so just anything that you can do to stand out. So what did you give to people? You know, you give them something, you know, to laugh about. They're laughing about Trina the cat, or, you know, I provide a short story that's for free, or, you know, we're just blog posting. You know, you give stuff away, and then, people are, you know, they'll take an interest in you.
So I did notice you have a tattoo of 122 Yules and also of your wife's cover. Tell me about that.
Okay, so I have a tattoo of 122 rules on my forearm, and my wife has got that tattoo of her book covers on her ankle.
That's her arm. Okay.
And so, yeah, and so we had been talking about this since we first met, about getting tattoos. One of the tattoos that I wanted to get on my wrist was Tenacious. And, you know, I've been looking for like a Chinese symbol or something to represent that. And finally we're just like, you know what? Let's just get the word done. So, when we got married, we went in and we got our first set of tattoos. And, then for our anniversary, because we were going to wait till my book came out, and we were both going to go in and get our book covers. And so, we contacted the cover artist, because the cover artist did both of our books. And, you know, said, hey, here's what we want to do. And so she made something up for us, and we brought it in to our tattoo artist. And she just went to town and did you know, both people just did brilliant work on us, just did brilliant work. Our artist who does our covers is the best. We hashtag Anita is amazing, because her name is Anita. And there's a reason why we say that. There's just nobody better. If you look at my wife's covers, they're beautiful. People will look at them and they're like, wow, those are just amazing. They're eye catching. And, you know, the blending and the professionalism that she did on my covers is just awesome. And so there was nobody else that we would have trusted to make permanent artwork on our arms. So we think we might go in. My wife might get one more tattoo. We've got our states on our feet, and you know, to show that, hey, you know, wherever we are, this is where we come from. Our feet will always take us home. Mm-hmm. And we've got our book covers, and we've got Tenacious, and then my wife and I each have each other's initial on our wrist too.
So I have a question. So 30 uh-huh. years from now, are you just going to be like a walking advertisement for your own work, or is it just the one
tattoo? It's just going to be the one tattoo. You know, it takes tenacity, we think, to write a book and to get it published and get out there. And, you know, we dated long distance across the country, and that takes, you know, and we survived it. And we've done a lot of things that I think would tear apart a lot of other couples. And it has just brought us together because we're both just tenacious, and we work really hard, and we really care about each other. And so, you know, that's where the tenacity comes from. So, yeah, I think we're going to stop at one for our books.
Great. Just a plug to your wife. I have read some uh-huh. of her work. You recommended her to me, and she mm-hmm. is a fantastic writer. Like, from like the first three sentences, you can just tell, like, she has really mastered writing. Just fantastic.
Right? She's brilliant.
Oh my gosh. Yeah, like you pick it out. Like, I'm excited to read her book. I'm a couple weeks out before I can get into it, but yeah, I read the first page just to kind of, like I said, I like to curate for voice and style, and it's just immediately you can tell this is a storyteller that knows what they're doing.
Yeah, I completely agree. I always joke that I liked her writing so much that I had to marry her. So, okay.
Background here. In the book, there's two characters we follow, Monica and Sam. And mm-hmm. they're very different people. And they come from very different worlds. And the characters are so well done. And I think what illustrates this the best is this little coffee shop in this small town. And so this is what I call an intersection. I know mm-hmm. in writing there's a lack of universality in the terms. And so in this coffee shop, there's a coffee shop, and then there's the lady that runs it. And so mm-hmm. both characters go in here, and they both interact with the women and with the shop. And so I read Monica and just kind of following her story. But then Sam walks into that same coffee shop, interacts with that same woman, and he has this line that it's an internal narrative line, not dialogue. It says, "Spotlessly clean, mm-hmm. the coffee shop had been decorated in what could only be dilapidated chic." And up until this moment in your story, Sam has done a lot of shady things in his training. Like, I was looking at him, be like, "How can you do this kind of stuff?" But then I read this line, and then I hadn't typed this into my notes here, but, and then there's another line, like, after she tells him she's engaged, and he just thinks about, he's like, "Yeah, and in 5 years, you're just going to be as miserable as you were before you ever met him." And it was in that moment,
right.
those two sections of Sam in this coffee shop, that I realized just how dismal his perspective on life was. And that's how mm-hmm. he could do those terrible things, just following orders. And for me, it was, mm-hmm. just, it was a brilliant moment in your writing, having these two characters intersect to really just show how different they are from each other. And you just have that strong voice for each of them in their perspectives.
Wow, thank you very much.
Oh, it was really well done. I mean, I have yet to see an intersect done better than Monica and Sam in the coffee shop. It was fantastic. So I dug around trying to find Monica's quote so I could compare them side by side, but I couldn't find it at the time I'd allowed myself to research.
Okay. Yeah. Thank you.
But yeah, it was really well done.
It's always interesting to me the things that will stand out to someone who's reading it. There's some things that you don't necessarily think about. There's one of my favorite scenes, which nobody else seems to like think much about, is the scene when Monica and Angel are in the desert And Monica's looking over the cliff, and she's thinking about jumping off and how bad her life is. And Angel, you know, gives her this big, long speech about being, you know, a zit on the donkey ass of society and everything. And she wants to Thelma and Louise it. Like, that scene always makes me laugh. And I always, like, whenever someone wants a quote from me, that's the one I always include. But, like, almost nobody else seems to appreciate that. It's kind of, it's always interesting to me, the things that people find, that stand out for them that have an impact. It's kind of, it's awesome. And, you know, and there's no way to predict it.
Yeah. Like, what is it? You've got to kill your darlings. And then it's only in the feedback from the readers that you see what was really well done. It's kind of interesting that way.
Yeah, totally. I love that you quoted Stephen King's memoirs. You gotta kill your darling. Oh, yep, absolutely.
I think that came long before Stephen King. I think that's Faulkner originally.
Is it really Faulkner? Okay.
Yeah. As far as I know, it could go back even farther. Yeah, I don't know if you attend a critique group, but that's where most of my darlings die. I'll write something, I'll just think it's fantastic, and nobody gets it. Nobody. I'm like, well, I guess that's how I die.
Well, I still left that scene in there, even though it's not necessarily anyone else's favorite. It's my favorite.
Okay. This is what I wanted to point out to illustrate craft.
Okay.
Just the line at Martin Ballard says, "Mr. Smith, do you need me to spell it for you?" And then this is how you approached it. You stay in the dialogue, H, comma, O, comma, R, comma. And I've seen a lot of writers try and spell things out in dialogue. And usually, unless the narrative instructs me, I don't get it. But with yours, I got it right away. And I wonder if someone pointed this trick out to you, or if that's just kind of your own approach to it.
Man, I want to be able to tell you, Joe, that I came up with that. But chances are very likely that Aaron might came up with that. My wife, she's probably the one that did that, because she's, like, really great at line edits and that sort of thing. It could have been my other editor. I'm guessing it wasn't me.
Well, because, like, there's not an industry standard, which is part of the problem, right? And
right, absolutely.
So, yeah, I thought your technique here worked really well. Like I said, I didn't need a narrative to kind of walk me through what was happening, because those commas broke it up so it was really clear. I just thought it worked really well.
Yeah, I think people do it with dashes and a couple other ways. But I think the comma definitely, once I saw it, I was like, yeah, that's the right way to do it.
Yeah. So I wanted to point that out. But I feel like that should become the standard, because it was just really clear right off the bat. Okay, so this is another line. Just because this month we're talking about word choice and just small wasted words that writers use, and so I wanted to use this next line because it's a contradiction to the rule and it works. And so this is the internal monologue from Monica while she's in the interrogation room. The entire purpose seems to be she's talking about the chair she has to sit in. Its entire purpose seemed to be keeping the occupant uncomfortable. It succeeded. Also, it was short. And so one of the things we tell people to avoid is also, because it's just, it doesn't really do a lot. But here, in the way you structured your sentence, it's clear that it's to create this emphasis on this last aspect. It really kind of, you know, it's kind of the landscape and centerpiece, right? The landscape is kind of uncomfortable, and then the centerpiece is, it's so short, but that is kind of what's making it so uncomfortable. And I feel like the way you frame that also is an exception to the rule of cutting out those little words, because it creates that extra emphasis.
I agree. You know, you try and be concise. One of the things about my writing is that I read it out loud. I do my editing, I edit, and then I read out loud. And I keep going and keep editing and keep reading it until it sounds right to my ear. And sometimes what sounds right to your ear doesn't always follow the rules. And case in point. And so you're just like, yeah, that sounds right. And it rings true. Right. So it's really hilarious that you bring this little sentence up, because this has been a controversy between my wife and myself. She's looking at me. She's sitting right next to me, and she looks over and she's smiling because I know exactly, she knows exactly what we're talking about here. Because I argued for this sentence, like, really hard. Like, a lot of, I went back on a lot of things. There were, you know, parallelisms and all introductory things, like all kinds of stuff. And I let go a lot of things, but this one I fought for because it sounds right to my ear. It's a little tiny sentence. It's redundant. It's passive, yeah. But it adds some punch. And I always, she's over here, she's chuckling next to me. It does. I've always thought it added some punch. And so, it's been one that my wife wanted to ask for my manuscript from the very first time that she read the book. But, and I think Anya, the content editor, also pointed it out, but I fought her for it too. And, you know, there's a couple times where an author has to plant their flag. You know, most of the time, 99.99% of the time, your editors are God. You know, you listen to them, but once in a while, you plant your flag. And this one I did. And I still stand by it, if for no other reason than it's funny, just this little story.
I think that's so funny. You've had to fight for this short little sentence. But you're right, because it does break all the rules, right? It's redundant, and, you know, it is that passive, and, you know, like I said, it does. But like you said, when you read it, it just rang true, and it did the same for me, which is why I quoted it here and wanted to talk about it, because it's a clear violation of the rules, but it works.
Mm-hmm. Right, and most of the time, you follow the rules, but once in a while, you know, obviously, 122, but, you know, most of the time, once in a while, you can break them if you do it on purpose.
Yeah. And for me, that, like, I feel like that's the importance of knowing the rules, is so that when you break them, you can say, I did it for these reasons, and I feel that works better.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly.
Okay, so being with the mm-hmm. Wild Press, how do you go about finding new readers?
Wow, okay, so that's tough. So new readers come from a lot of places. A lot of it is word of mouth. So you get, like, you know, there's several different words of mouth that we're talking about here. So go to Comic Cons, and I sell a lot of books at Comic Cons. And you get to talk to a lot of people, and it's kind of funny, depending on the crowd. You know, we went to a Comic Con in not too long ago, I don't know, 4 or 5 months ago, and that one, I sold a ton of 122 and not very many of Birth. And this last Comic-Con we went to was, and my wife sold a whole bunch of books, and I sold several copies of Birth. But, you know, people weren't interested in 122. So it was kind of, it depends on the crowd, but you get to meet people and you make contacts and you know, you learn about different cons and you learn about different ways of marketing, and, you know, just everybody's really great there. Everybody kind of promotes one another. And so, you know, that's one way that you get new readers, you know, and another way is that, blog posts. So people who follow your blog go, hey, you know, I read this article by you, and you've got the little tagline at the bottom about how you wrote these books. And if they like what you wrote, then they might be apt to go and follow your, to read about your books too. So, and of course Twitter, where you make friends and create relationships online on Twitter, and you interact with people, and you're not promoting your book, you're building relationships. So that's the best way. And then there's blogs. My wife and I both did blog tours, and we did one where we did jointly, and that was really fantastic, because bloggers, they're awesome people. They've got lots of contacts, and you know, most of them are willing to bend over backwards. You know, you write a blog post for them, and they're, you know, happy to promote it and happy to post it. And so then you get exposed to all of their followers, and at the same time, you're promoting them. So you know, it's a win-win situation. So, you know, you're promoting them and they're promoting you, and, you know, and you get to know one another's people. And so that's another way that you find more readers.
One more question. Why the pen name? You know, with a lot of the brand building and different things, why choose the pen name?
Okay, well, I've got a couple of reasons for that. First of all, my regular name is really common. My last name is Scott. And if you want to Google Scott, you will just find millions of hits. But if you Google Deke Rue, I own the first three pages of Google. Like, you cannot do better than that. Because I originally was gonna publish under my regular name, but after, you know, realizing just how awful it is to try and find me, then I decided to find a pen name. And so, you know, that's when I asked my wife if I could borrow her maiden name, and I took her dad and asked if it was okay. And, you know, he was more than thrilled. He said, there's the more ruse, the merrier. And of course, then I could do my hat tip to, you know, to Stephen King.
Yeah, well, I think that's a really good reason to take a pen name. Like, just Google yourself and see where you fall. And if you're not landing on the first page, you know, pen name's probably a good way to go. That's a great idea.
Yeah, well, there's pictures of us like all over the place, and it's great having my wife and I with the same last pen names, so that we can, you know, we cross promote. You know, you Google me and you find pictures of her and links to her blog and vice versa. So, you know, we're, you know, not just married, but we're this writing marketing team.
Awesome. Okay. Why don't you tell people where to find you and your work?
Yeah, Joe. Yeah, you can go to my webpage. Go to deekrubooks.com. I got links to all of my books, the Amazon links. There's a free short story on there. You know, there's a contact page. There's, if you're interested in any of that, I've got quotes from the book. There's all kinds of great content on there. You can also just Google me. And if you Google it, then, you know, you'll find me, DeekRhew. And, you'll find us. If you just Google Rue, I think you'll find both my wife and myself.
Awesome. All right. Hey, thanks for your time.
All right. Thanks for listening. As always, our website is startwriting.space. If you want to email us, it's pleasestartwriting@gmail.com. If you enjoy the podcast, leave us a review on whatever platform you're listening on. And if you read a book, leave a review. All right.
122 Rules by Deke Rue. Chapter 1. Monica and the three goons in the death wagon drove for what felt like an eternity. A man with the chest and shoulders of a linebacker and a face chiseled out of granite sat opposite her in the back seat. Clad in a three-piece suit and dark sunglasses, he had first captured, then belted her into the large SUV. But now it seemed the fun for him had ended, and he only glanced her way on the occasional mile. The man in the passenger seat with the broken nose ignored her, giving his full attention to the road ahead. The hood of his sweatshirt had fallen back, revealing the bristles of a crew cut as sharp and squared away as a Super Bowl field on the morning of game day. He wiped his sleeve across his upper lip, leaving a trail of blood on the dingy gray fabric. After their altercation earlier, his groin and ribs had to be aching as well. A thin smirk of satisfaction played across her lip. If only for a moment, she had had the upper hand. Monica's smile faded as her thoughts returned to her predicament. She sat behind the driver. Maybe a chop to the neck or a blow to the temple would disable him. Would that cause him to lose control of the vehicle? Could she grab the wheel and yank it? If they crashed into oncoming traffic, would she be able to escape the twisted metal and broken glass? Though she hadn't seen the driver's face, the thickness of the man's shoulders beneath his suit jacket rivaled granite. This man could swat her off as easily as an annoying spider. She couldn't outmuscle them, so surprise and distraction were her only allies. Surely these meatheads carried weapons. Could she startle one of them, maybe scream in driver's ear since he was focused on navigating the busy streets and would be less able to react, then grab his gun? She would hold the barrel to his neck, forcing him to pull the car over and blast anyone that tried to stop her. The idea had merit, but Granite sat only inches away. He would enjoy subduing her. Though the idea made her nerves cringe, she could dive out the door. They did that on TV all the time, fall and roll, right? looked simple enough, but she doubted it worked in real life. In the movies, no cars ever trailed behind the hero as she made her escape. Most likely, she'd be mowed down by one of the insane taxis that prowled the boulevard. At the very least, she'd break a leg or twist her ankle, and they would recapture her. But the closer they got to wherever these brutes were taking her, the faster her viable options dwindled. Seeing no alternative, she tensed, fingers wrapped around the door's release handle. Steeling herself, she took a deep breath and pulled the lever. The door didn't budge. Shit. Child locks. Of course these guys would have thought of that. She looked up to find Crewcut watching her. He pointed at her lap. You forgot to unbuckle your belt, too. Her eyes dropped to the buckle. Duh. The corners of his lips curled up, then he turned away to watch out his window, uninterested. Shit. No one said anything for a few miles. Finally, Monica turned to Granite. Look, before you kill me, can I at least call and say goodbye to my family? As time and distance slipped past, Monica ran and reran each scenario in her head. Each new option of escaping these men seemed even less likely than the last. They surprised her when they turned into an underground garage. Driver handed a plastic card to the stern security guard who met them at the gate. Another guard stayed back but kept his hand on his holster. He hadn't drawn one of the several weapons hanging from his belt but looked competent and ready to go to war at the slightest provocation. The first guard, who looked like he drank from the same steroid-laden stream as Granite, examined the embossed card, made a call, and waved them through. These were not rent-a-cops. She hadn't known what to expect, but certainly not a military-like fortress. Maybe an abandoned warehouse. Her mind refused to imagine what they had in store for her there. Or a deserted pier, followed by a swim in the Hudson. At least they hadn't made a ride in the trunk. They parked, and then, in unison, the three men got out. Evidently, only she required a child lock. Granite came around and opened her door, but she didn't budge. After a few seconds, he unbuckled her belt and lifted her out of the car, with the same odd gentleness he'd used to deposit her into the seat. Learning from the mistakes Crewcut had made earlier, they surrounded her as they marched into an armored, unmarked door. The entrance had no handle. Instead, Driver swept his card and typed something into the inset keypad. He looked into the lens of the nearby camera mounted on the rough-hewn rock wall. A second later, the door buzzed and clicked. Driver opened it. She glanced about, desperate for any opportunity to escape as they ushered her inside, then down a long, dimly lit, colorless hall. Granite pushed through one of the many indistinguishable side doors into a narrow room. The small space, save two chairs and a table, had a can-it-be-more-obvious that it's one-way glass mirror covering half the far wall. Granite took a position in the corner, perhaps to ensure her cooperation, perhaps for intimidation. Monica turned from him to the rail-thin woman who trailed in his wake. Her severe features were exacerbated by a bun so tight it pulled the corners of her eyes back, as though a discount plastic surgeon had arrived intoxicated to her facelift. She wore a crisp white shirt, creased blue slacks, and no makeup. As the woman began to thoroughly pat her down, Monica grabbed the woman's arm and twisted it around. "Get your hands off of me." The unmistakable click of a gun next to her ear made her blood freeze. Swift and as silent as the wind, Granite had stepped forward to protect his coworker. Bad facelift yanked her arm free, giving Monica a knowing, satisfied glare. She finished the frisk, even taking Monica's watch and plucking the ring off of her finger. Then she waved a wand over Monica, searching for telltale bits of metal. Granite had taken Monica's phone, purse, and satchel bag when he had first apprehended her. The stern woman had them in a large plastic sack and now added Monica's jewelry to the haul. Both Granite and Bad Facelift left, closing the door behind them. Monica tried the knob, but of course it refused to turn. Shit. She pressed her face against the one-way glass, cupping her hands around her eyes to block out the light. If she stared hard enough, she might be able to see who watched her from the other side. Only her own reflection stared back. She banged on the glass. "Hello? Anyone in there? You can't just lock me up. I get a phone call." When no answer came, she examined the door. She had seen a movie where the hero had escaped by punching the pins out of the hinges. But Monica had no tools and tore off part of her fingernail after a few minutes of fussing and grunting. She wrapped her knuckles on the entrance's surface, but it felt solid and heavy. The handle seemed the most vulnerable to her efforts, but she had nothing with which to jimmy the latch open. Cursing, she kicked the door and began to pace. The windowless room had no clock, so she had no way to know how much time had passed. At this rate, though, she would not be attending tomorrow's legal ethics class. She stopped and looked around the small space. Maybe not the one after that, either. She went back to the window and searched for gaps in the frame. Having found nothing, Monica pressed her ear to the space between the bottom of the door and the floor. Only the sound of air moving through the ducts greeted her. She tried banging on the glass again. "Hey, anyone home yet? I need to pee. Keeping someone from urinating is considered cruel and unusual punishment. I go to law school and know about such things." She pounded again. "Hello?" Still no reply. Frustrated, she slid to the floor, her back against the wall, and started counting the holes in the ceiling tiles. When she reached 1,000, her stomach growled. Just as she considered throwing one of the chairs through the window, a short, bespuckled man swept into the room. He wore a crisp white shirt, blue tie, creased blue slacks, and shiny black shoes. This guy in bad facelift must shop at the same military surplus supply store, all spit and polish. He carried a file and an air of casual authority with him. He smiled at her, probably to put her at ease, and only kicked up her anxiety a couple of notches. "Hi, my name is John Smith. Sorry for the wait. Can I get you anything? Water? Tea? Coffee? My phone and a cab ride home?" John chuckled and sat down, motioning for her to do the same in the opposite seat. "So, Monica, is it?" She nodded and followed suit. Her chair, the no-frills, no-specific-color plastic variety, reminded her of a larger version of the kind she had in elementary school. Unlike the one John sat in, hers had no rollers and didn't recline. Its entire purpose seemed to be keeping the occupant uncomfortable. It succeeded. Also, it was short. When she settled into her seat, John towered 8 to 10 inches above her, even though when standing, he only came up to her chin. Monica seethed at the obvious strategy for psychological dominance. He could play both sides of the coin from this position. Even when he smiled, she could see bad cop right beneath the surface. Everything that had happened since they'd nabbed her at the library had been designed to intimidate her, locking her into the black SUV, ginormous goons, leaving her alone in this little room for hours on end without her cell or any way of contacting the outside world. Now this little demonstration of authority. She screwed in her resolve, refusing to give in, sat up straight in her chair, staring into the little man's eyes. She would make him blink. "Seems you had a little meeting today," good cop smiled. "Please tell me everything," his eyes seemed to say. In her psychology classes, Monica had studied ways to get information from people. One of the most effective techniques was to make a simple, open-ended, often wrong statement, then remain silent. In response to this non-question, the other person, who more often than not would start babbling, if not to correct the inaccuracies, then to fill the uncomfortable empty space. Monica didn't answer, letting the quiet spin out. Several tense but wordless minutes passed. He seemed reflective when he continued. "Not sure what part you played in the operation. We also didn't see how you got there. We've been trailing those guys for months, waiting for a meeting just like that one. You must have slipped in before we arrived." "You mean the little tryst between Baldy and the guy that sounded like Joe Pesci?" He chuckled again, though it sounded forced and placating. Just barely good cop. More like annoyed cop. "Yes, that. Look, I don't know what this is all about. I was just reading, minding my own business, when these guys showed up and started talking. I don't know what they were talking about exactly, but it sounded shady, so I did the good Samaritan thing and tried to help." Good cop vanished like an apparition. "So you want me to believe that one of the biggest drug dealers in New York and his favorite knee buster just showed up without a care in the world and started yammering about their business right in front of you? Only a couple of people knew that meeting was going to take place and you coincidentally happened to be there? That's what you're trying to tell me." Indignation fed her building rage. "I don't know about the meeting, and I have no idea who those guys are. What I do know is I don't want any part of you," she pointed at him, "or any part of this. I've got midterms to study for, so unless I'm under arrest, you have no right to hold me. I'm leaving now." She stood and started moving towards the door. "You understand that it would be easier to take you seriously if you hadn't just been arrested on drug possession." Monica rolled her eyes. "It was only a gram of coke. At a small get-together back in Alabaster Cove, a friend of mine gave me a little as a going-away present. I forgot about it, and when I got pulled over for speeding, it fell out of my purse. I did a few hours in custody and was released. You obviously have the report, so you already know all of this." "I see." He had opened the folder flat on the desk and appeared to be reading. She stood next to the door, arms folded, fingers drumming against her bicep. "Can you easily explain the time you spent in juvie for murder?" Oh, shit. Dread flooded her veins and invaded the hollow of her gut. Monica moved slowly back to her seat, her very short seat, and dropped into it. Her eyes settled on the picture John casually perused. They were upside down to her, but she didn't need to see them to know what they contained. Blood on the floor. Blood on the bed. blood splattered in a rainbow pattern across the wall, a dead man with his head caved in, a baseball bat with Louisville Slugger in blue script, and clumps of scalp and bloody fingerprints, her fingerprints, along its sleek, oak-colored length. Her body threatened to disengorge her stomach's contents right there on the no-colored floor, and only by Herculean efforts did she prevent the tuna salad she'd had for lunch from making a grand reappearance. "I thought those records had been sealed." Her voice sounded barren and deflated even to her own ears. "I thought it was illegal to access them without a direct order from the court." John smiled a non-smile while his eyes drilled into her skull. "What you need to understand is that we are above the law. The sooner you get that into your genius-level head, the easier this will be." Defeat as thick as molasses dulled her senses and deflated her spirits. When she didn't answer, he continued, "So let me spell this out. Someone with a history of drugs and murder has recently traveled across the country. She allegedly attends school, but has no formal address, and as far as we can tell, no friends. Her instructors say that she has well above average intelligence, but only sporadically attends class and speaks to no one. This woman with almost no social ties and little traceability attends a meeting with a high-powered dealer and a hitman. You're a smart girl. Do you see the picture this paints?" The little man sat ramrod erect in his high chair in an attempt to make himself a larger-than-life bully. Compensating for something? Heat and anger replaced the liquid lead that had clogged every thoroughfare in her circulatory system. "Look, if you actually had anything on me, I'd already be in jail. But as seeing as how we are having this little conversation and I have no cuffs on, you clearly don't have any proof. Just access to records that you shouldn't and a wild imagination for the dramatic. Thus, unless you plan to formally charge me, I'm free to go." She stood again. John shook his head. "I can see your law classes are paying off, but what you've learned out there doesn't apply here. As I told you, we are above the law. I'm afraid you're going to miss a few more lessons before this is done. A process has been started, and there are no shortcuts, no quick paths through it. Please just relax and let me guide you." "I don't need guidance. What I need are answers. Who were those guys? Who are you, for that matter? You haven't exactly explained that. Tell me, John, who exactly do you work for, and what do you want?" He shook his head again. "It doesn't work like that. I am asking the questions. If you cooperate, maybe I'll answer what I can. If you don't..." He paused. "We will be here a very long time." The underlying threat hung in the air. Good cops seemed to have left on a bus for parts unknown, and bad cops' mood had gone sour. Dread returned in all its syrupy thickness. "Okay, now that we have that cleared up, are you sure I can't get you something?" Good cops suddenly returned with a sarcastic smile. She shook her head. "Fine." He closed the file with the damning pictures in it, folded his hands on the desk, and looked at her. "Here's what's going to happen. You are going to explain everything that went down this afternoon. Start at the beginning and do not leave anything out. Do I make myself clear?" For a moment, Monica held herself tall, but soon she slouched in her chair like an amateur boxer that had gone 3 rounds with the champ and lost. Badly. She nodded. "Good. Whenever you're ready." Monica took a deep breath and began. "I went to the library because I have a huge criminal law midterm coming up.